So I went today, this week and next week, to discuss Chanukah a little bit. Chanukah is coming up on Sunday night, and it's always worthwhile to prepare for the Yom Tov before it comes. So you're ready for it, both physically and spiritually. So physically, everyone gets their menorahs out and gets all the candles ready to go. But spiritually, you have to understand the concepts of the Yom Tov to make it meaningful. So I was like picking out different concepts of the Yom Tov. Every Yom Tov really has... infinite amounts of what there is to discuss, because there's so many ideas surrounding every single Yom Tov. So you have to choose like one point to focus on. So I want to focus today on a comment made in a medrash. Now, just I guess to put it into context for a second, I point out every single year that the battle between the Jews and the Greeks of Hanukkah, we don't see it just as a physical battle. It wasn't just a matter of who's going to control Eretz Yisrael. It was a clash of ideology. It was two ideologies going up against each other, so it came down to a battle on the battlefield. But it was really ideologies which were opposites of one another that had a conflict and had to somehow resolve that conflict of ideology. So traditionally, there's actually four different malchios. There's four empires we view as sort of the empires that rise up against the Jews and fight against our ideology. It was true historically, and it's true in concept that each one represented a different concept of philosophy or of the ideals they stood for, and they rose and they fell, and the Jews remained afterwards. So those four empires were Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome, and those are the four different Golios. There's four different exiles the Jews had to endure based on that, and Hanukkah is celebrating the clash and the victory against the Greek Empire and the Greek exile. That's Hanukkah. So what ancient Greece is known for, in particular, as we mentioned years past, is their advances in the world of knowledge, meaning science, philosophy, architecture. I mean, ancient Greece is really what we look towards for the basis of all modern day academics and thought, etc. comes from ancient Greece. We live in a world they call the Greco-Roman world because it's really built on the basis of Greece and Rome, and that's where we are in the Western world these days. That's what we're built on. So we have to explain these ideologies, how they stand in opposition to the Torah ideology. And there's a lot that we take from Greece in value, and there's a lot that we reject. And it's always kind of confusing to tread that line, meaning we appreciate science, we appreciate philosophy, we appreciate architecture and beauty, but we also have a different angle on how to view it. And that's always the balance between the Greek ideology and the Torah ideology and how the two work together and how the two clash. So let's illustrate. I'm going to use a medrash to illustrate at least one point about their ideology and how it clashes with ours. So this is a medrash which is speaking about a pasuk, a verse, way back in the beginning of the Torah in Bereishis. It's the second pasuk in the entire Torah. And the pasuk describes the lands... I was reading it from the text. You don't have to open up yours, but I'll read it from mine. It says, "Ve'aretz ha'sovavohu." The land was empty and void. "Mechoshech al panei sahom." There was darkness on the face of the abyss. "Ruach Elokim," and the spirit of a god, "merachefes al panei amayim," was hovering over the water. So the rabbis in the Medrash, they see this as a description of the four exiles, meaning already in the very beginning of the Torah at creation, in the second pasuk in the entire Torah, there's already a reference to the four empires and the four exiles. Simply because when we describe the land being empty and void, so these four different empires are a manifestation of the emptiness and the voidness of the world. Now the Jews are here to bring it this fulfillment, and these different forces are coming to sort of empty it out from that meaning. So the four words quoted in this pasuk, sohu, vo, choshech, and tahom, emptiness and void and darkness and abyss, each one represents a different one of the four different empires. I'm not going to get into each one in particular, that's not our discussion today, but the word choshech, darkness, represents Greece. And obviously it's very appropriate that the way we celebrate Hanukkah is through light, because if Greece represents darkness, then we celebrate the victory through the light of the menorah. So, but the Medrash brings out a very interesting point. The Medrash says, "V'choshech ze galus Yavan." The word darkness in this verse refers to the exile of Yavan, the Greek exile. "Shechshicha einayim shel Yisrael," because they darkened our eyes, "b'gzeirasehen," with their decrees. We know that what the Greeks did, they weren't out to kill us, they were out to to stop us from keeping Torah, from observing mitzvos. So what they did is they made lots of decrees against us. Religious decrees. It was religious persecution. They said, you're welcome to remain alive, you can join us, you can prosper, just assimilate. But if you're going to keep to your Torah, then we have problems with you. So they darkened our eyes with their decrees, with their laws. And the Medrash quotes one decree in particular, which is a very, very strange, you know, sort of obscure decree. What was the decree? You can actually look at lists. There's probably about 30 or so decrees we have sources for that they made against us. You know, the most famous were not to keep Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, and Bris Milah. Those are the most famous ones. But there's probably another 25 or so which you can find listed in other sources. And it shows you how broad sweeping their decrees were. But this Medrash points out one particular decree. It says, they told us, Kisvu lechem al keren hashor. You have to write on the horn of an ox, She'ein lechem chelok b'lkei Yisrael, that you have no portion in the God of Israel. So, simply, if I have an ox, and I want to go plow my field with it, I'd have to take out my, some sort of knife or something, and carve into its horn, that I have no portion in the God of Israel, and then I can use my ox. But if I didn't do that, the Greek police force would come over to me and they would cite me with a ticket or arrest me or who knows to do what because I didn't follow their decree. So there was a decree to make sure we carve in the horns of our oxen this phrase that I have no portion in the God of Israel. A very, very strange decree. Obviously there was some intent behind it. Like what do they want? Why an ox? Why this phrase? Why carve it in the horn? Like what exactly was the point of this? It's a very funny thing. But this is what the Medrash highlights as one of the primary decrees of the Greeks, that we should write on the horns of our ox with no portion of the God of Israel. Very funny thing. So what did they want exactly? So simply that this phrase, Ein lechem chil b'kei Yisrael, is a reference to a verse you find at the very end of the Chumash, in Ha'azinu. I'll read you that one.
From where is this source that you're telling us about?
It's a Medrash Rabbah, Rishis Rabbah. That's the source for this. And it seems to be referring to the Pasuk in Hazinu. It says, Ki chelek Hashem amo. God is the portion of his nation, the nation is a portion of God. Yaakov chel nachalos, so Yaakov is a portion of his inheritance. So the Torah says, Ki chelek Hashem amo, the nation of Israel is chelek Hashem, is a portion of Hashem. And the Greeks said, no, write down on your ox that you have no portion in Hashem. So they saw that there's a concept of us being the portion of Hashem as being a very primary concept, and they said, we can't tolerate that. You have to write down that you have no portion in Hashem. That was their decree. So, again, why were they attacking, you know, this particular point? Why was this? You know, they attacked a lot of things, but this is was emphasized. You have to write this down on your ox that you have no portion in Hashem. What does it mean? So the idea of having a portion in Hashem, when it says chelek Hashem amo, that we are a portion of Hashem, what does that mean? So it seems to denote the special bond of God and the Jewish people. Now we're not just another nation out there; we're God's portion. Now God gives us a special love, a special care, special guidance, special hashgacha, divine providence. And that's all part of being the chelek Hashem. We're a portion of God. It's a special bond. It's a relationship. It's like a partnership. You know, we have it in for each other. You know, we're in it together. That's how we view it. The Yavanim, the Greeks, didn't want this. They couldn't tolerate that as our philosophy. And let's explain why. So when they said, write it on your ox. So all the commentaries say that the ox is supposed to be a reference to the Chet Egel, the golden calf. Calf is a baby cow. Ox is a adult cow. So it was a cow. And the idea of writing it on the horn of the ox was supposed to be, in some way, invoking the Chet Egel, invoking the sin of the golden calf. What was the message? So the commentaries and the Medrash say, the message is that because you worship the golden calf, therefore God has now distanced himself from you. No longer are you God's portion. Could be that you were. I mean, nobody wants to deny the revelation at Har Sinai. That's something that they accepted as well. That's something which most of the world accepts even to this very day existed. But what they do, as even modern-day Christians do, they say at a certain point you lost that relationship. You know, so the Greeks said it was when you worship the Chet Egel, when you worship the Egel Azov, the golden calf, at that point what happened, you became distant from God, never to come back together again. That was their point. They wanted to stress that to us. The And the truth is, the way we view the whole Maamar Har Sinai, when we stood there at Mount Sinai receiving the Torah, we view that as a wedding between us and God. That's described as a kala at the chuppah. It's, you know, you're the bride standing by the chuppah, and you're ready to marry God. That's the Jewish people are the bride, God is the groom, and we're supposed to bond. What happens? Right there at Mount Sinai, under the chuppah, we go and we worship an idol. So it's looked at as the way that the rabbis describe it. It's an act that is so, it's so terrible, because imagine the bride at the wedding runs off with another man, like right from the chuppah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the description of it. Aluva kala shezinta tachas kupasa. How disgusting is it if a kala acts in an adulterous way right at her chuppah? I mean, you can imagine the chutzpah which is there, how despicable it is. And that's how it's viewed. So we can understand that maybe that notion is, you know, we can understand the notion that how dare you stand at Mount Sinai and worship an idol. It was a despicable act, and it really was. So the Greeks wanted to take this act and say, well, that was it. Finished. Once you did that, God cut you off, and no longer is that relationship there. But when we say Chil Hashemo, that God, and that we are the portion of God, that's talking to the eternal bond of God and the Jewish people. And we say, no, we have an eternal bond, even though we make mistakes. And yeah, the worshiping the golden calf was a pretty bad move. You know, we agreed to that. But God didn't reject us. Now, even right there, at the moment, God was upset. But he did not reject the Jews as his people, and that bond remains. That's our perspective. The Greeks said, no, write down on your ox, meaning in reference to the golden calf, you have no portion in God, God's rejected you, you're finished, relationship is gone, and you're the same as any other nation. That's what they tried to tell us. The rabbis tell us that this is actually pointed out in Moses Tzor, it's mentioned in the Mishnah as well. The Greeks, they when they came into the Semikdash, they didn't destroy it. And we know that. They defiled it, they didn't destroy it. What they did to those, they actually poked holes in one of the outer fences. We say partsu chumos migdalai. That they, partsu means that they breached, they put holes into the walls of my tower, referring to the Beis HaMikdash. So the Mishnah talks about, now which wall did they actually poke holes in? It says they poked 13 holes. In which wall? So there, one of the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, one of the surrounding walls, is called the Sorig. It was basically similar to like a lattice or chain link fence. And it divided between where a non-Jew could go and where a Jew could go. So this was like, you know, it was like the fence that said, no non-Jews passed here. No Gentiles passed here. That was the fence. So understandably, they didn't like that fence. Because in their mind, the Jews aren't special. I mean, if you want to relate to God, we can all relate to God. And if not, then not. What makes you think you have a special standing? What makes you think, Chil Kashem Amo, that you are God's special portion? We're like all the other nations. You know, God rejected you. We're the same as you. So that wall stands against us. And they poked holes in that wall. That was their attitude. A Jew is no different than a Gentile. There's no special relationship. What they had us write on the cow was, you have no chil be'elokei Yisrael, the God of Israel. God of Israel means that, it's not that he's only the God of Israel, he's the God of the whole world, but he has a special relationship with Israel. That's what it means, that he has a special relationship with the Jewish people. And they said, no, you have to say you have no portion in the God of Israel, because that relationship is not special between you and God. That relationship is for the whole world or nobody. But Jew is not unique. There's nothing special about you versus anybody else. That was the message they were giving us. We worshiped the golden calf, and we were rejected and finished. So, but the answer is the following point. The answer we say is no, that's absolutely wrong. Chil Kashem Amo, God is, we are a portion of God. Our relationship that God made with us is eternal. He made a bond with the Avos and the Imaos, with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and that bond remains despite the fact that we sin and make mistakes. And that bond doesn't change. But they couldn't stand that notion, and they attacked it. So that's one point the Medrash is bringing out. There's a second point. When you say that Chil Kashem Amo, that we are the portion of God, so portion means that you actually have a piece of it with you. That's what a portion means. I have a piece with me. So we have a concept that the world of spirituality can connect with the human being here in this world. It's a very Jewish concept. Other religions might cite that spirituality and physicality don't actually meet. They're separate things. There's a spiritual realm, there's a physical realm. What's physical is not spiritual, spiritual is not physical, and finished. The Torah concept is that's not true. Kedusha, sanctity, actually bonds with our world. We can take an item which itself is mundane, and inject within it kedusha, sanctity. So you have more obvious examples and less obvious examples. So for instance, we have a Sefer Torah right over there inside the Aron. It's just a piece of parchment made out of leather and some ink. But we view it as having real kedusha to it. The way you have to treat it, the way you have to, it has to be buried, you stand when it passes by, there's kedusha. A karban, we used to bring sacrifices. The animal was actually became sanctified. The animal became holy. There's special rules that apply to it because it became holy, and there was sanctity inside a goat or inside a cow because the kedusha, the spirituality, bonded with the physical world. Beyond that, we see the human being. The human being has a soul within, and that means the human being is actually both physical and spiritual at the same time. The spirituality, the spiritual realm, it links to us, it bonds with us, it becomes part of who we are, and therefore we actually become sanctified in the physical flesh, and it's all the same. There's no. It's not that you can't be physical and spiritual together. You can be. Now that's a big principle of the Torah. So chilka shem amo means that the world of spirituality and sanctity can and does link with the physical realm. There's a big difference in the. There's a bracha that a person is supposed to make upon seeing a non-Jewish scholar and upon seeing a Torah scholar. The level of scholarship needed to make this bracha is not so simple to achieve. And I'm not aware nowadays what secular scholar deserves the bracha. There are probably certain rabbis, the biggest rabbis out there, that might deserve the bracha for the Jewish scholar. I'm not sure who gets the bracha for the secular scholar. I don't know enough about the secular scholars out there which would deserve it. But the bracha upon seeing a secular scholar, a non-Jewish scholar who is a scholar in science or other general fields, the bracha is shenasan mechachmasil basar v'dam. You make the bracha baruch atah Hashem kinim al-cholam, shenasan, that gave of his wisdom to flesh and blood. So this person is an extremely wise person. They've achieved tremendous knowledge of secular in the secular field. So you make a bracha on seeing them. You become inspired by such a person who's so wise, and you say God has bestowed upon this person his wisdom. And that's the bracha. If you see a Torah scholar, you know, a world-class Torah scholar, so the bracha you make is shechalak mechachmasa l'reyav, that God has not given, but the word chalak, same as we said chalak before, has apportioned or has divvied out of his wisdom to those who fear him. So if you just note the Hebrew terms used, for secular wisdom the word is nasan, he gave it. For Torah wisdom it's chalak, he apportioned it, we'll call it. He gave him a piece. So why is it different? The answer is very simple. When it comes to secular knowledge, the knowledge remains separate from the person. So let's say you take Einstein. Einstein was a very knowledgeable person, and he knew physics very well. But it's not that physics became him, he became physics. It's that he was a person, the physics didn't sanctify him, the physics didn't change him, the physics didn't link up with his whole being. He was very smart and understood it very well and was able to make a lot of progress in the field of physics. When it comes to a Torah scholar, the concept always is that the Torah bonds with the person and changes them and sanctifies them. Whenever a person meets a real Torah scholar, the Talmud Chacham, he's a different kind of person. He lives sort of above this world in a different plane. There's a happiness, there's a care. They're living in a different realm because the Torah that they've studied has actually changed them, has moved them, has inspired them, and has become part of who they are. It links to them. So we say cholak. Cholak, as we said, means that there's actually some sort of connection. We are Hashem's portion, meaning that we're sharing something together. The Torah knowledge in a Talmud Chacham is being shared by God with the person. It bonds with the person and becomes one. That's the idea. Secular knowledge is not like that. As someone who knows science very well, it doesn't become part of the person and change them and sanctify them. It just is knowledge which they have. They possess the knowledge, which we respect and make a bracha upon seeing it. But it's a different. God gave it to them. It was given out. Versus that we're sharing a portion together. That's the difference. So this concept is very much counter to the beliefs of ancient Yavan, of Greece. Because they understand that there's knowledge, there's a human being, and that's all physical. It's all able to be understood and detected inside, through scientific means, through human reasoning, through the human mind. But the fact there's something beyond this world of spirituality, of sanctity, that bonds with the physical, that's something that they didn't believe in. And the concept is that the Ramban says this, but it's known, it's obvious. The Ramban points out, he speaks about the students of Aristotle. And Aristotle, obviously, we look at as sort of the father of Greek thinking in a certain sense. And the Ramban says that Aristotle and his students, or people, that they would deny anything they could not sense with their own senses, and that their mind did not come to understanding as rational. And they said, if you can't understand with your mind, then it's not true. So this stands very much against the Torah, which says there are things out there that are beyond us, and we can't understand everything. And just because I can't detect the soul inside a test tube, there's no microscope that's going to see the neshama. It doesn't exist. There's no formula you can come up with to measure spirituality. It can't exist by definition. It doesn't mean that there's no spirituality and there's no neshama. It just means that it's of a different realm, but it's here and it connects. The students of Aristotle tell you no. They tell you that if you can't sense it with your five senses and you can't discover it in a scientific lab and there's no equation you can use to explain it, and philosophy you can't use your human mind to define it philosophically, then it's not real. And there's a major difference between the two. So when you say Chelok Hashamo, is that the spiritual becomes part of who we are, and the ancient Greek and even the modern day person following in those footsteps, they say that no, either we can see it and feel it and detect it scientifically, or it's just not there. It's not relevant. It's irrelevant to us. So the concept of Chelok Hashem Amo, that we are God's portion, that there's a spiritual portion in every single Jew, it stands up very much against the grain of what the ancient Greeks believed. So they made us write down on our ox, "En lechem chel b'elokei Yisrael." You have no portion in God, meaning that don't think that the spirituality of God links with you. You want to say that God exists? Go for it. But that you have a portion in God, that God links to you, that we can't tolerate. It's a fascinating thing, this word chelik, like we keep saying, God's the portion of God. So we mention it in the story of Hanukkah, as we describe in the Medrash. It's mentioned in the blessing which is made upon seeing a Talmud Chacham, a great Torah scholar. It's also mentioned, probably other few other places as well, but one place it's mentioned is in the bracha made at a bris. When you give a baby a bris, so the bracha following a bris, one of the terms used to describe God is chelkenu, our portion. And it fits in very much with the concept we're describing. The bris is coming in to put a sign on the physical body that this baby actually relates to a spiritual realm. This baby, who's just a physical baby, born of physical parents, of flesh and blood, this baby has stamped on his body from 8 days old that he lives for a higher purpose. That's what a bris is. It's saying that the physical actually can be there to portray a much higher cause. So at the bris, we mention God as chelkenu, as our portion, because we're actually emphasizing the fact that we have a portion in God, that he's not just out there, but a portion of God is with us. A portion of God is within us. That spirituality is within who we are. And we see that. We as Jews, we can see the sanctity in an animal. We can see the sanctity, as we said, in a carbon. We see that sanctity can come into the physical realm, and we're very comfortable with that. So the Keren HaShor, that horn of the ox, that was the Greek ideal of telling us, they're trying to dispel the idea of sanctity and property. Property cannot be sacred. You as Jews, and it's interesting, when they say you should write on your ox that you have no portion in God, that means that we as Jews are supposed to be able to see in the ox that we have a portion in God. As we take the ox and plow our field, we're supposed to sense that this is a spiritual undertaking because we're doing it in the service of God. And the Greeks said, no, property can't be holy. You can't have sanctity in an ox. That's impossible. What do you mean that this big piece of meat over here can be sacred? It can't be that way. We say it's the other way around. Chelok Hashem Amo, that we are a portion of God. That same pasuk mentioned in the Hazinu, ki chelok Hashem Amo, that we have a portion of God, it actually concludes Yaakov Chevel Nachalaso. Yaakov is the Chevel of God's inheritance. Now what's a Chevel? So Chevel could also be a form of portion. Chevel is also a rope. And the Nefesh HaChaim, Rechaim of Elohim, he gives the following metaphor. He says that you have to view that Jews are like a rope of God. In what way? If you're weighed down the bottom of a mountain, and there's a rope attached to the top, you can shake the rope, and on the top, the rope also shakes. So he says that we're down here in this world, and we're in the physical realm, but we're attached by a rope up to the spiritual realm. And the actions we do down here actually shake things up in the spiritual realms. There's a rope attached between us and the spiritual. We can't see the rope anywhere, but the rope is there. And that's the neshama. The neshama is a piece of spirituality in the person. And that neshama links you into the spiritual worlds. And as you do actions down here, you do good things, you're shaking things up there for the good. You do bad things, you're shaking up things up there for the bad. But you're shaking things up in the heavens, despite the fact that you're down here. So it's the idea that the physical attaches to the spiritual. We read in the parsha 2 weeks ago that Yaakov saw in a dream, he saw a ladder with its feet planted on the ground, and Rosho, the top, was up in the heavens. And that's a description, many say, of the neshama, it's the soul, because it's something planted in our world that has its connections way up in the high heavens. It's that ladder, but we connect to both worlds at once. The Greeks saw this world, and they said there's no link to the spiritual. There could be a spiritual realm, but it doesn't link to our world. That's not rational, it's not scientific. I can't describe it in words. I can't develop an equation to measure it, so it's irrelevant to me. The Kedusha of our world is a new dimension, though. It's a dimension which it can't be sensed physically, but it could be sensed. You know, we can sense sanctity in our own ways. You need a sixth sense for it, but it's there. But this is what sets apart the Jew from the Greek. The Jew says that God is Mekadesh Yisrael. God sanctifies Israel. God sanctifies Shabbos. God sanctifies the time, you know, in terms of holidays. The body has sanctity, property can have sanctity, everything can have sanctity. It's the neshama spreads even into the physical person and even into our possessions. There's a concept discussed in commentaries that you find the possessions of tzaddikim themselves actually take on traits of sanctity. For instance, the Gemara says that even the donkey of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, one of the great sages of the Gemara, Rav Pinchas ben Yair, his donkey would not eat food that didn't have the meiser, the tithes properly taken from it. I mean, non-kosher food. So the donkey was not that religious, trust me. It wasn't like a religious donkey. But the point is that the owner of the donkey was so spiritual and so sacred that that sanctity spread to his possessions. Because we own something, it links to you. Mm-hmm. And the sanctity just spread out to all his possessions. So the donkey itself just naturally could sense this food is off. It's not kosher. I can't eat it. Not because the donkey was so religious, but because his owner was that holy. And that's what happened, because we understand that Kedusha, the sanctity, could spread to everything in the physical realm as well if we do the right things. The way we celebrate Hanukkah is by lighting candles. So the idea of a candle, you know, we view, if you were to take one thing in this world that's physical, but it's the most spiritual, it's fire. Fire is something which you can't touch it, and physically there's nothing to touch, and you put your hand right through it. It provides light. Provides warmth. It's, you know, we talk about light being something from the heavens, and it's always striving upwards. The Baal Tanya points out that fire is always trying to move up to its source, right, which is the source in the spiritual realms. So it can't make it because it can't leave the wick, but it's always striving higher. Spirituality in this world is like that. It's actually the perfect metaphor for the spiritual and the physical. It has to link to a wick. Fire without something to burn can't exist either. It has to have something to burn. If the fire leaves when it's burning, it just disappears. So it has to be linked to the physical, but yet it's something which is consuming. It's spiritual, it's light, it's, you know, it's bright, and it consumes. The our most famous example of spirituality in this world was Moshe at the burning bush. The fire comes to the bush. It has to go in the bush. It has to link to the physical. But yet it was drawing its nourishment. And the reason the bush didn't burn is because it drew its nourishment from the spiritual realms. So it didn't have to burn the bush. It has to be on the bush. But really the full nourishment came from the spiritual worlds. So you light your candle in Hanukkah and you're actually seeing in front of your eyes this model of the spiritual linking to the physical. That's the best we can do, at least, is with fire. But it provides for us that light and that warmth. And you're supposed to sit there and look at those candles and take in that light. Hanukkah is a yomtiv where the observance is done inside the home. You're not allowed to light your menorah elsewhere. It has to be in the place that you're living. So you could be away for the day. That's where you are. But it's where you are sleeping that night is where you're supposed to light. Because it's trying to show you that the spiritual comes into the Jewish home. It's not, spirituality is not only in the shul, not only, you know, if you're in a place where people are doing spiritual acts together, even in the middle of your living room, even at the doorway of your house, when you're in your kitchen, there's spirituality. So you have the mitzvah done, in particular, in the Jewish home. It shows the spirituality which links to the Jewish home, and we look at that candle with its fire connecting with the physical wick and displaying for us the spirituality linking to the physical. So that's what Chanukah teaches us. So if we were just to put this all together for a second, you know, the Greeks came in and they told us, they said, write down on the horn of your ox that you have no portion in the God of Israel. They're denying spirituality in the physical. They're denying the Jews being God's special nation. They're denying the fact that you can have something in this world which is here, but not scientific. They're denying all of that. And they wanted to stress that to us because that was their contention with who we were. So we, when we celebrate Chanukah, we tell them the exact opposite. We say that, no, we Jews are a special nation of God. We light the fire and the menorah in our homes to publicize the miracle, publicizing that God took care of us and gave us a special miracle to save us. We view those candles as a spiritual, you know, force linking to the physical, and we take that to heart. And that sort of dispels all these notions that the Greeks were had against us. So that's one important idea about Chanukah.
Nice. Okay.